netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our focus for this episode is the new release, Jurassic World Rebirth. Our guest is director Gareth Edwards and production side supervisor David Vickery, who also served as one of the second unit directors. Now, this podcast won't be about spoilers or in-depth VFX breakdowns. We'll leave that for later with our other coverage here at FX Guide. Instead, this is a discussion of the creative process on the project, things like the decision to shoot on film and how that impacted things in post, how closely Gareth worked with David and the VFX team, how they dealt with a really short production timeline on the film, and how Gareth's respect and appreciation for the original Jurassic Park film played a big role in impacting the current one. Now, I guess I say this every time, but I think you're going to really enjoy the guys' chat. It's really cool to hear while the two work together and also enjoy the process. So let's go ahead now and cross that conversation.
Well, thanks, guys, so much for being here. And Gareth, I believe you guys are recovering from the New York premiere last night.
Yeah, I didn't drink. I learned the mistake from London. It's not good to drink when you've got press interviews the next day. But yeah, it was basically, so we showed the movie to an American audience. It was the first big massive screening I've had over here. And it was amazing. There was cheers and applause and gasps and all kinds of reactions that you don't really get elsewhere. That was super rewarding after the craziness that was this production. But we'll get into all that, I guess.
I was surprised we got cheers in England, which you never get. Like, people are silent in the cinema in the UK. And it's obviously like it's a favorable audience. But lots of cheers, lots of really like great reactions.
I always just assume that the studio, like when we're in London, there was some like reactions because British people don't react to anything, right? And so I just thought, oh, the studio paid people to like clap or whatever it was. Or there's a lot of Americans in here, which I concluded was the case.
Well, they didn't pay anyone to clap in my screening, which was an advanced screening, but nevertheless, it was really well received here in Australia as well. So the official premiere is going to happen in a couple of days here. Hey, so Gareth, last time we spoke, and it was a great chat. We were after Creator, and you and I were like having a really, and you went, but you know what? I'm going to not do any more big films right now. I'm going to go and do my own project. And I was like, oh, really? Well, that's great, man. I just really respect you kind of taking that attitude. And then I look on the trades at like what seemed like a moment later, and it's like one of the greatest franchises of the modern era. Like, what happened?
I spent the last year convincing myself it was a little film that was a passion project. It was basically, what happened was, it's a weird thing because Jurassic Park, to all, I think everybody on this is like a classic. Is half the reason doing what we're doing for a living, and so the idea of especially this kind of movie, which is kind of like harkening back to the original a lot more, it was borderline sacrilegious to do it. And then what ended up happening is that when I say Steven now, like we're really good friends. When Mr. Spielberg or God asks you to do a Jurassic Park thing, you just kind of get checkmated because you half don't want to do it because of the bar is so high. But then the other half is like, I cannot spend the rest of my life knowing I got the thing you've always dreamed of, which is Steven Spielberg asking you to make a film. And especially this film, it was like a giant love letter to all his early work. You know, David Koepp, who wrote the script, was a big fan of his, obviously, before we got to work with him. And you could just feel it. And this was such a great playground. It was a no-brainer. There's just no version where he's going to say no to that. And then we did, like David will tell you, but we tried to convince, you try to block it out. Like, if you think about the fact that at some point it's going to be out in the world like it is, you get paralyzed. And so we really did honestly, for about 9 months in post, we were in Soho in London. There was the editorial floor, and then above it was the VFX floor. And I literally it was a 14-hour day, 7 days a week for 9 months. And I'd come into the edit, I'd hang out with Jay Bears, we would cut some stuff, and we'd go up, see David, we'd hang out with him and a few others from that department, review shots, go back down to the edit, and then leave. And it was you arrive in darkness and leave in darkness kind of thing. And And it felt like we were making a film with five of our mates, you know.
But it was 6 hours a day you would sit with us for visual effects. It wasn't like, let's do a 1 hour review. It was 5-6 hours every day, 6 days a week, 7 days
a week.
But
David, that kind of relationship with a director isn't common and must have been a bit of a gift.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I have to say, we had a great time. Like, we, you know, you come together in those moments and it you're under incredible levels of stress, and you can work on projects where, you know, there's some anxiety and there's a bit of angst between people and you don't all get on, and it makes it so soul destroying to come to work every day. And we just had a great time. Like, it was sort of like being at school and just having a good time, and everyone was trying to make good stuff and do a good job. And, you know, hats off to Gareth. He knows what he's doing. He's got a really good eye, and he's not afraid to get involved and actually do it himself. And it was just like, felt like everyone was mucking in, trying to do whatever you could to get the show to look as good as it could.
What I really liked about it in terms of the feeling of it is that it had the same sense of wonder at times that the original film had, in a way that wasn't wonder at visual effects. Obviously, visual effects were central to it, but it was just like a wonder and a joyness. It wasn't just banging out, you know, gotcha moments. But a lot of that wonder must have been stuff that you were developing during that time, right? Because, I mean, on set, you can only go so far to a certain extent. There was like breathtaking stuff here that, I don't know, did you feel like you had that in camera?
Basically, it felt like that, like, even though every single shot is a unique problem that you're trying to solve individually, the thing that they all had in common was that you're trying to do two things in parallel, right? Simultaneously. And you're trying to land on one of these two as fast as possible. One is realism, like, you want it to look real. But I could take a photograph, I could put my phone out the window, take a picture and show it to you, and you go, yeah, that's totally real, but it looks shit. And so the other one is beautiful, right? And sometimes you can have something that's really beautiful, and the more beautiful it is, the less real it will feel. And the more real something is, the less beautiful it will feel. And so you're trying to get this both. You're trying to look like you were the world's luckiest cameraman, and you just happen to get this moment where everything worked out, but it feels totally real. Otherwise, you know, the visual effects, it's not going to work. And so every time we do a shot, we're trying to land on one or the other, and you go, oh, okay, either will do. And if you shoot real footage, you know, in real locations, at the very least, you're going to get the real. Do you know what I mean? So even if you end up replacing every single detail in that shot, which sometimes we would, you're starting with something real, and then you're trying to make it more and more beautiful. Or, you know, David and his team would do some really nice matte painting, and it would just be a rough idea. It could be quite painterly. And then it's like, okay, that is it. That's the composition. That's the light and dark. Now you've got that pain of like trying to make it look real. And that can be hard. You know what I mean? Like, this stuff sounds straightforward, but you just know it. You've just got that spidey sense. Human, every single person, you don't have to be a VFX anybody. You can show someone something, is that real or not? And they'll know.
You said that a lot, actually. You said the spidey sense word is like, you can look at a shot and go, yeah, there's just something, like, and you don't necessarily know what it is, but it doesn't look real. You get it a lot with green screen shots in cars, where you're just like, I just know this is not real. And it's the hardest thing in the world to fix, because Gareth would go, yeah, it's great, but it's something, my spidey sense, what is it? And so then you've got to try and figure out what that is. Another thing Gareth did a lot was, it's your point about that line between something that's beautiful and real. And we'd show Gareth a shot, an establishing shot of an environment, of this fantastic looking place, and go, yeah, this is great. But just imagine that the camera person that was there, that was photographing that, they waited for like 3 weeks to get the perfect light, just to wait for that perfect moment when the light was doing exactly the right thing. That's the version of the shot we need. Like, the landscape is great. The composition of the image is good, but the light needs to be different. And Gareth has this sort of Bible of imagery, whether it's studies of light, of landscapes, or formations of rocks. And you just have this never-ending Bible of reference that you would share with us that we could use for inspiration.
Let's fold in discussion about John Matheson, because he was a DOP that you hadn't worked with on Creator. Was Greg, right? And so I think it was one of his earlier films. Was it? I think I made a note. It was like Kingdom of Heaven, right? That you mentioned that you really liked the look of. Can you talk to me about that, Gareth, and like why you went to that film as like a kind of a touchstone?
If you remember, Mike, the very first time we ever met and chatted was about a TV show I did, visual effects for, about Attila the Hun.
Yep.
And it was, I had to do all the effects myself in my bedroom, blah, blah, blah. And it was very intimidating. And one of the things I did is I digitized Kingdom of Heaven and grabbed every single frame from that, because it was the high benchmark of like how to do like a medieval battle. And the more I looked at each frame, the more I was going, oh, fucking hell, this is really good. Like every composition is so strong. And it did all those things we're talking about. The light is beautiful, but real, you know. And obviously Ridley Scott is a major, major part of that. But John Matheson, you know, was like really stood out to me. And so it's always been in the back of my mind as someone just to watch and be a fan of. And then when this all came around, it was like, you know, it was a fast process, right? And so a lot of people were busy or doing something, and you start to panic and go, oh my God, if we can't get someone good, I don't know if I want to do this, you know what I mean? And basically we started going through this list and getting more and more lists of people that were available, and suddenly John Matheson's name popped up. And I was like, oh, thank God, I've got to get him. And so we did a Zoom, and I saw an opportunity because we did this Zoom and the HO, basically the production team, like the producers, were like, we've got to hire this guy, whoever it is, we've got to hire them like this week. So you've got to go and scout, and then you've got to shoot the movie. And so knowing there was this tight deadline, I was on my own with John, and I was like, hey, John, I really want to shoot on 35mm film. How do you feel about that? And he went, oh, it sounds great. You know, loves it, and blah, blah, blah. And he went off on like tangents about magenta and things. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is so like exactly who I want. And then I go out of that Zoom meeting and I turn around, John's interested, he's up for it. But on one condition, as long as we only shoot on film. And they were like, oh, and then this very long process of everyone linking arms, David, me, John, everyone just going, no, we're going to shoot this movie on 35mm. And mainly it was a weird thing. It was just because of that aesthetic. I've been chasing that look ever since I started making films. And that like that Spielbergian quality, that kind of early 90s, 80s, you know, Panavision, you know, Kodak vibe was like super high on the agenda. And weirdly, you think to yourself, with digital technology, it's going to make life harder. I mean, David, you can speak to this, but I feel it was the opposite, right?
I feel, you know, that anamorphic film is so beautiful. And it's not about having something to hide behind, but it's about having something like a canvas that you're working into, whether it's, you know, the
into it, isn't it? Yeah, not on top of it. It's into it,
yeah. And there's all the beautiful aberrations around the edges of the highlights and the distortion and warping and the emulsion. And it's just something to bed into rather than this really sort of quite clinical and clean image, which is wonderful. Like digital is wonderful in many films, but I did really enjoy working on the film.
So you shot in Thailand, which is, you know, like obviously a valid choice, but like from Monsters or on Creator, like, I was trying to think of how to articulate this before we got on the call. And I was thinking, you're an opportunistic director in the sense that you kind of take things that the environment presents to you. And then obviously on Creator, that was really the case, right? Where you were filming and not sort of deliberately putting that guy in a suit and that guy as an actor, but working on it. How did that technique of yours translate to this film, Gareth?
In a few different ways. One way was it can't, right? In that we had a limited amount of time. If you're trying to reinvent the wheel on a major movie like this, you're going to derail it and cause a lot of problems for yourself. So half of it was like, okay, we know, got to choose our battles in how we like do things differently. I think David became second unit director along with Ben, who's the stunt supervisor. And just like on the creator, there are, you don't know what you want, you know, half the time. You kind of go, I think my main steer when David would go off and get drone footage and things like this, where, you know, it would be like, just get an A to a B. Like, don't just get a shot that does this. Get a shot that's like, in every axis, it's moving from an idea that's A, idea number A to like, to a B, and have the camera moving. And I don't know what the palette's going to be. It doesn't matter. Just get a whole library of this stuff. And then what we did is in the edit is we would just trawl through that stuff. I would grab all the best. Because you might get a really nice camera move, but the light's rubbish, you know, and something like this. And you just get lucky with the weather. And so there's suddenly these like, these little moments we go, that's really nice, you know. And so ended up, there's, for instance, there's a shot. This is not a spoiler at all. There's a shot in the movie where you see a boat, I'll just say by a beach, and these little birds take off, and the camera just comes down, it finds a cave. And that was actually, I think, Dave, you'd gone and shot, you were doing these potential reveals. It was reversed, and it was played backwards and all these, and then we added the cave, and so you're just trying to find a little piece of Lego bricks that you can then manipulate and break apart, play backwards, flop them, and like, so you're not starting from, you're not trying to build a cave and a coastline in 3D, you know what I mean? You've got something to start with, even if you're reinventing most of it.
I was intrigued just to watch the way you work as well, in that, you know, you would frequently roll on a 1,000-foot roll of film and shoot the whole roll. And you do these incredibly long takes, and it just gives you, both you and the actors, the time to sort of settle into the piece. And you do get much more honest moments, I think, from the cast and the performance. So you start to find those accidents, as it were, that happen as you're sort of watching these longer moments play out in front of you. But that's something you've always done, though, isn't it?
So
you're
connecting back to our discussion earlier about that kind of realism and beauty thing. Like, one of the things that I think destroys the realism is when you have unmotivated or oddly sort of choreographed camera moves. Like the blocking, like the how you frame the shot, and like what, when you choose to, whether you anticipate a move or not, a lot of that stuff is what I think is subconsciously feeding that sense of realism in the first place. So I guess, question for you, David, did you find that like it was, because obviously there isn't things in frame sometimes when you're doing stuff. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, if that blocking just feels weirdly choreographed, then even though what's in it might look real, it just doesn't feel like a realistic kind of interpretation at that point in the story.
Yeah, and like historically, on the previous Jurassics, we've done everything we can to have, whether it's a virtual representation of where the creatures might be or puppeteers or something, but we did very little of that here. And I think another thing Gareth's really good at, he's good at quite a lot of things, unfortunately, is composition, yeah? And he really... You spend a lot of time in post-production getting the compositions of the shots to work and to make sure that the camera feels like it's motivated by what's in the image and not completely missing the point. So I was really surprised, because often when I'm working on visual effects shots, you flop the shot, as you know, halfway through the process. You've seen it 1,000 times. So you flop the shot to see whether it works mirrored. And when they don't work mirrored, it's because the composition is inherently completely broken in the image. And you know that there's something wrong with it at that point. And you can flop the whole of that movie and it still works brilliantly well. It's because, I don't know, you're a sort of bit of, you're a cinematographer at heart, I think, as well, Gareth. And so I think he's somewhere in your mind, you're seeing the finished image when you're watching these shots. And then it's how you convey that to us and how we manage to realize the same thing.
Is that true, Gareth? Are you seeing the finished shot, or are you just seeing what is an opportunity to take in and then rework to get what you want?
I don't know what anyone else is seeing. So I don't know what I see that someone else isn't, but it's like definitely you're picturing it there when it's not. I mean, obviously.
But I mean, like, are you saying I've got enough stuff that I can make something out of this? Or are you saying I'm going to keep going because I don't feel like I've got exactly what I want yet? Because it sounded like you took a lot more film than tennis balls to Thailand.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you just, I think I would operate when it was handheld, I would operate. And I don't really know why I was doing that, because I'm very happy not to operate when it's wheels, you know, when it's the smoother stuff. And Chris did all that on our movie. And yeah, I think what you're doing, I tell you what I did do with Chris, which was interesting, probably annoyed the shit out of him. But there's obviously a monitor, you're both watching. And obviously he doesn't know what we're really intending to put in there. You know what I mean? He knows it's a dinosaur, but he doesn't know where it's going to walk necessarily. And he's composing. And so I would put my hand over the screen like I was the dinosaur. And, or even sometimes the more annoying one was, say if this was the screen, I'm just pointing at where it is. And then like I'll move, and I'll just put my finger and tap off the screen and he would move it. And it was just to kind of like, it's up there, it's that way, it's down a bit. And he's trying to frame it like this. And I think, yeah, it's, you know, what's weird is I remember early in the conversations we had with Universal where they talked about the time frame and all the problems with like trying to do a film like this in a year and a quarter. And then suddenly, obviously, the elephant in the room that everyone's worried about is goes visual effects. And it sort of surprised me because I felt like, oh, that I didn't lose days or a moment's sleep over the visual effects on this movie. Like David is so on top of it, and it's my wheelhouse as well. Like it's sort of fun. And like you sort of go, oh, it's going to be fine. It's going to be more like, it's the fun of finding it, you know. And I was worried about everything else. Like everything else was what scared me. But the visual effects is always like, that's just considered okay. You know, we're going to, and also just to be complimentary to David for a second, David's got an amazing eye as well. And so I sort of micromanage this process sometimes, but I found with David, it was great because sometimes I won't be able to crack a problem visually, you know, where you're just going, why is this not? And you're trying to push and pull in and you're like, what's the matter here? And you could just let David, you try it. And then he would sit there in these reviews and he'd just go, what if it's up here? Maybe it's more up there. And you'd be like, oh shit, that's good. Why didn't I think of that?
No, I think you were sitting there going, oh, that's a free pass. We can let Dave try that. And if it doesn't work, I can have another go. But
yeah, because it's not technically my, I didn't waste time.
Not your note.
It's not my crack at it, right? So if Dave has a go, exactly, it's like, well, it's my let fault. You do your thing. Now it's now my, because you know, you get like the three strikes, you're out.
It's still ILM's turn, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the people at ILM, do you know what they all, and again, I think it comes from this like mentality that, you know, hopefully Gareth and both I had, which is, we're just going to have fun making this film. And we're going to really appreciate everything that people are trying to do. And there was no shouting. There was no like finger pointing when stuff didn't work. And everyone at ILM came to the party with this really positive attitude of, we could try anything. And if it doesn't work, that's okay. But they give it everything they had. And it really paid off. And, you know, we thought water was going to be a really big problem on this show.
Well, I was going to say, like, if I was jokingly paraphrasing this to, like, my wife, I'd say it's Jurassic Water Park because there's quite a lot of water stuff. And that is challenging in many 50 respects.
50 pages right? of the script wow. was on the ocean, on the open ocean. And, you know, met with Dennis Stewart March 2024. And he was looking for places to shoot it. And we were talking about the approach and the methodology. And we could have been on the ocean or in a tank, an infinity tank. We could have been on a stage and it was a really big concern of mine going in. That was the thing that I thought was going to be the theme of this project was, and I'm not diminishing the work ILM did because what they did is made the water excellent and not a problem. And it actually became like a story motif in the film, like it really is like a character in the film, strangely, and it's quite astonishing what they did. number of times we were watching shots and Gareth and I forgot whether we shot it on the tank or it was the open ocean, because you just couldn't tell.
Look, I'm not just saying this. It was completely seamless where that was shot. It all looked to me like it was shot at the same place. And not just that bit that you're referring to, but there are other points in the story where water appears again or is a plot point, and none of them felt disconnected, which is, you know, that horrible thing you don't want, where it looks great and then suddenly we're in a studio and all the light changes and all the, you know, you can tell that it's closed and then suddenly it opens up again. And that didn't happen. And that's full credit to both of you, because it's, I have no idea how you did it. I look forward to finding out in the future, but like right now, like it was just immediate.
But and John that, as well. Yeah. Like it's hard. John Knoll has said this a million times over, but what if you get a great plate, you can make a great visual effect shot. But if you get a bad plate, you cannot make a great visual effect shot. And John Matheson gave us some really amazing photography to work with. So hats off to him as well, I think.
Hey, can I ask you one thing? Because loop back on the, you're talking about Steven Spielberg, and obviously there's a lot of notes there. But as I understand it, he was involved well into the process. But to a certain extent, as I understand it, right, there was a point where he kind of stepped back and let you take it from there. Is that how it worked, Gareth?
No, sure. I mean, you know, he's very respectful to directors because, you know, he knows exactly what it's like. And I felt like basically during pre-production, as we were setting up the world, what is Jurassic, what's not Jurassic, dinosaur what, star-wise, I felt like, you know, like, you know, what would Jesus do? It's like, what would Spielberg do, right? And like when we were working on Star Wars, you often would go, what would George do, you know? And you didn't know because he had retired, you know? And we'd be sitting there going, what would Steven do? You know, and he'd be like, I'd do this. You know, you'd get an email or something. He'd be like, what would he do? If he was here, what would he do? I told you, I'd do this. You do that, you know? And so it was kind of like really good to have him. His, you know,
I can imagine that'd be quite helpful.
Yeah. And so like we did things like when we were in like situations where, say, for instance, T-Rex, Antoine, who designed the T-Rex and it was fantastic, we ended up going, okay, we want to do a different color scheme. And then there was like too many good options. There was like six really good color schemes. And you sit there going, well, all of these would work. And then you think, how do I have the path of least regret? And it felt like, well, we send them all to Steven and he picks it, because then it's like canon. You know what I mean? It's like having the seal of approval, it's official Jurassic. And so we obviously like would send him stuff, and it felt a bit like he was that is Jurassic, that's not Jurassic, you know, in terms of design and stuff like that early on. And then once we got filming, I didn't know how like present, you know, it would feel, because I knew he was watching all the dailies, and it's very intimidating.
Yeah, I imagine it would be.
Yeah, to shoot a film knowing that, you know, the greatest, probably, you know, you could argue ever, you know, filmmaker is watching everything you're doing, and you'd get quite paranoid, and then suddenly a text would come through. I remember Frank Marshall, who was on set, you know, obviously did things like Raiders of the Lost Ark and that. He came up one night and he gave me his phone. When an older person gives you the phone, you think they're struggling with some settings or something. They need some help. And so I was like, what is he trying to find Wi-Fi or something? And then I looked at his phone and there's a picture of Steven Spielberg. And I'm like, what a strange screensaver to have, you know, obviously they have a close friendship or whatever. And then the screensaver moved. I went, hi, Gareth. And I was like, holy shit, it's a FaceTime with Steven. Fuck. And I was in the middle of filming and I just wasn't like prepared to be holding God in your hand like that, and it just freaks you out for a second, and you end up like, I was trying to like just get the actors over and talk, and then the second he says something nice, he's talking about what he'd seen the day before and things like this, and he's complimentary, it's just like it's the biggest shot in the arm, you know what I mean? Like you just feel like you've had spinach and your Popeye or whatever. It's like, and everyone's like, come on, let's go, you know, even though we were having a real struggle in the conditions. Because Jurassic Park's a masterpiece, and knowing we were up against like going to be compared to that film no matter what, it is an impossible task. And so we tried to approach the whole movie a little bit like, imagine they made this film around the time they made Jurassic. And then they just put it on a shelf for whatever reason. We've made too much money this summer. Let's just park this one. And then, you know, come 2025, someone goes into the vault and finds this reel of film and Jurassic World Rebirth. And they're like, what's this? And so they just released it this summer, but it has all that feeling and vocabulary and style of back then.
What's really interesting is, for me, like, I was picking up on, there are a lot of Easter eggs that are nods to Jurassic, right? Some are like more obvious than others. And they're just nice, beautiful, like little, you know, thank you notes, really, visually. So you say, especially at the beginning of the film, but what you avoided was doing a greatest hits. And I think there's always pressure to do greatest hits because it's like, well, we'll just do what they did before because everybody liked that. And then you get the same gag repeated. And the second time, it just isn't as funny. And quite frankly, you thought you wanted the greatest hits, but actually you want something new and it becomes kind of forgettable. So you must have been very conscious of this, right? Respectful and actually putting little homages in that are deliberate kind of notes, but also you didn't remake Jurassic Park, I guess is my point.
Yeah, I was trying to, it's funny because it's like I was trying to do my best impression of Steven Spielberg and it turns out Steven Spielberg is a genius and he's really hard to imitate. And so every time I failed at my impression, that's when my stuff ended up in the film. And so I'm glad it did in a way, but it was through failing that it had its own tone and difference. It was, and also it's that fine line. It's very similar to doing Star Wars and all that stuff in that you go slightly left and you're just copying the original film. If you go slightly right, it's not Jurassic. And so to just be in that sweet spot between the two, I mean, that's basically what you're doing all day long, every day. It's just, no, that's too similar. That's not a Jurassic film, you know, and you're just nudging things the whole time.
That process that you're describing there of just like tiptoeing either side of the line is exactly the opposite of the process you encouraged us to do with visual effects. Cause you know, you would give us a brief on something and you'd say, but don't just do it a little bit. Because we're going to spend the next 6 months going a little bit more. Go all the way to 13, because it's much easier for us to sort of dial it back to a perfect 10 if you jump all the way to 13 and try something really brave and try something really bold than it is for you to just slowly incrementally creep there. And the amount of times that we got really beautiful shots and broke them just to make sure that there wasn't something slightly better out there. Gareth has this kind of horrible ability to sort of just keep trying something in case you don't want to leave anything, the chance that there's something slightly better out there. So he'll keep asking everyone that he's working with, not just visual effects, to try to be slightly better.
I think there's an American expression about leaving it in the locker room versus leaving it on the field, right? Like, yeah. Hey, can I just ask you a quick question about logistics, just so I understand it correctly? I know you're shooting on film and stuff. Like, if you were shooting drone stuff, that must have been digital, obviously. But leaving that aside for a second, you're shooting a bunch of film. But as I understand it, that was all processed back in, what, the UK or in LA? Like, there was a serious amount of time delay between, so you'd have seen it on a split. But a split on a film camera, for those that don't know, is like nowhere near the image fidelity that you get on a digital split. Did you feel like, well, I'm just going to have to trust everyone because by the time we get to look at rushes, it's going to be like, what, days later?
2 days. Yeah, we got a telly cine. We had a 4K. Everything we shot, we scanned immediately, but it had to get on it. You know, there were twice a day. We had dailies going back to Bangkok airport, and then they were flying back overnight to London, and they were getting developed. And then, so I think it was up to 48 hours after we'd finished shooting that we saw it. We had digital taps on the cameras, though, didn't we? They weren't terrible. Yeah. They were a lot better than I'm used to seeing. But it was quite scary when you're only shooting somewhere for 2 days and you're going to leave that location before you see any of the rushes come back.
You know what's super interesting? I'm just fascinated. Like, an eternal fascination of mine is why, on average, and I'm biased and I sound old, films were better a while back than they are today. And obviously that's my personal opinion, right? And And there's lots of reasons, and there's a million conversations you can have about it. And I now suspect that one of them is to do with shooting on film, and that not everyone could see everything. And so basically there's this massive faith put in the camera and the people operating the camera, and you just have to blindly accept they got it right. And you can't come in with notes and have loads of opinions, because they feel they did or didn't get something. And I found more than any other movie had less, virtually no one came up ever that I can recall where someone had a comment about the image. It might have been something to do with a line of dialogue, something else, but it wasn't to do with, I'm looking at this image and I'm a bit worried about something, because it was so hard. It looked like security camera footage, it wasn't great. And so it took all that off the table. And as a director, that's nice that people aren't coming up and second guessing the image choices and things. And so I started to go, well, I think maybe that's what used to happen in the old days. No one had a clue because they couldn't see it. And so I thought that was a real benefit.
You had a really good cast and some actresses in particular on this film that I think are just great in anything they've ever done ever. But did that also play into your role with them? Because again, nobody's seeing that back in high quality. So they're putting their faith in you in the same way you're talking about putting your faith in, say, the camera team.
Yeah, I guess so. I think what David was alluding to earlier was I was sort of frustrated, because you kind of like, what happens is you go, okay, there's going to be a shot in this sequence where this person runs out. And as they run out, once they're running out, the camera's going to do this to this position. And they see that. And then as they turn, this will happen, right? Or whatever it is, you're doing this little elaborate move. And if you had your way, what you'd do is you just do that one shot and you go like action, and they run out, you go, blah, 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 you'd have a few goes at it. Okay, got it. Next shot is this shot, right? But the problem was we had a stack of those shots. And I had, in every scene, there was like maybe four or five from one angle about these specific little camera shots and moves. And if you did the maths, you start doing the maths and go, we're only really getting through, a few setups, a scene. And so you start to have to amalgamate the setups into one setup. And so you end up with these really elaborate camera moves that last the entire scene. And you're basically getting this shot, that shot, and then it comes around here and gets that shot, and then it lowers and gets that shot, and then it pulls back and it gets this one. And I think you get disappointed about that because you feel like you're compromising and like fishing for these shots as you go. But the upside is, I think the performances, the actors really start to get into the scene and really stop caring and being self-conscious. They're not being told to walk forwards, stand there, and then look there at that cue. And my proudest moment is Dave the Grip. It's not a VFX heavy scene, but in the museum, that whole scene is one take, and it goes on for, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes or something. And we've got other shots that it cuts in with. But at one point, he's worked on all these massive movies with Ridley Scott and people. And you go, and you're like going, what's the hardest thing you've ever had? We were just making small talk at one point. You go, what's the hardest thing you've ever had to do in a movie? And he goes, well, it's last week, what you did. And you're like, what are you on about? And he's like, in the museum. It was like, that was, because normally the grip is asked to go, like, this is A, right? And then that's B. And if you're kind of ambitious, you go A, B, C, And he said, you had 19 camera moves. And he goes, and 7 rises and falls, And I was like, yeah. Because you always feel like you're not trying hard enough. You know what I mean? Like, that you're just compromising all the time. So whenever someone like David, in post would go, you'd feel him like feeling uncomfortable because we were doing something that's not been done before, or the hardest thing or whatever. You're like, yeah, cool. It feels like, okay, now we're doing something different, it get exciting.
Plus, I mean, if you are that guy that's pushing the dolly, like, you don't want to be the one that missed take 9 or mark 9 when the actors are giving exactly the performance that everybody wants, right? So like, they're providing the platform to let you get the performance, and they don't want to muck that up. So the pressure on them must be enormous.
Yeah, but it's But then you do, you honestly will end up doing, I don't know, like eight takes or something. And so, so one of them's going to be okay.
Yeah, but so I mean,
Gareth never gets frustrated with people for trying. Like, if you give it everything, if you give it a go, you're never going to blame someone for making a mistake, I think.
But yeah, it's that Ron Howard thing, isn't it? About just assuming that everybody that's turned up on set on any day is there to do a really good job. And so you just provide the environment to let them do it. I loved how Ron Howard characterized that. It was just like such a positive attitude towards his crew, you know, not there to yell at them, he's there to let them do what they've come to work to do, kind of thing. Yeah. How big was the VFX team on this? Was it, and where was it based, or in one location, or was it distributed?
Yeah, there were 1,500 shots in total, and ILM handled nearly 1,200 of them, predominantly in London. Right. And we had teams in San Francisco, Vancouver, and Mumbai as well. I'd say north of 600 artists total in the visual effects at ILM. And then we had a team of important-looking pirates as well, who, I don't know, there are probably 100 people there. We had another in-house team, Midas VFX, who worked on our in-house, and Territory and Blind were working on graphics for us. So, I mean, traditionally, Jurassic films aren't very visual effects heavy, strangely. They're not Marvels. They're not 3,000 shots. So, you know, 1,500 is the biggest shot count we've had on any of the Jurassics.
Oh, really?
Up to this point, yeah. The last one was only 1,250.
And Gareth, you alluded before that this was quite a tight timeline to get this made.
Yeah. We had to do turnovers. I can't remember the numbers, but you remember. But it was like during the shoot, it was like suddenly having to turn over like 150 VFX shots whilst filming was pretty tricky, just because you got no headspace for it. You know, you're trying to plan the next day's shots, and then you're having to watch all the footage to find 150 VFX shots, and that was really painful trying to get those turnovers happening.
The whole thing was really short. Yeah, we started mid March. 24, we delivered the beginning of May 25. So, I mean, what was it? 11 weeks of prep, 13 weeks of shoot, and 30 weeks of post. So rapid.
Well, look, I'm so glad that it's finding such an audience even in these early stages. And it is a really good, like, return to Jurassic Park in every sort of possible way. I would be remiss, though, Gareth, if I didn't ask you, does this mean that you're now going to go on to another private, smaller project, or is that until Martin Scorsese calls?
Goodfellas 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm genuinely excited about the future. There's just crazy tools around the corner that just feel like they're going to liberate filmmaking in some way. And it's just, I don't know, I feel like there's an opportunity. I get excited about it, and we'll see what happens. But I always felt I was born in the wrong era, because, you know,
really?
All those great films. Well, yeah, because all those great films happened, in my opinion, a lot of the things I love all happened in the 70s. And
God, I would say exact opposite. I think you were born in exactly the right era where you could get involved and have, like, the ability to produce stuff, like from the Star Wars stuff, the Godzilla stuff, like the even the original Monster stuff, right? That's just really nice. You know, like, there's great imagery, but you're really nicely in the middle of it, as opposed to standing, like, you know, back from it and having it, like, going off over there and coming back 6 months later. Like, I mean, I don't think, surely you would not be happy if you were remoted from the process, but you can get involved in a digital age.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was getting to, is that, retrospectively, I think it has been a good time to be a filmmaker, but I think it's going to get even more fascinating over the next 10 years. Who knows what's going to actually happen, but it's definitely, things are going to change a little bit, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, guys, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for that, guys. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us and share some really cool insights behind the process. For those of you who don't know, Gareth actually taught a course for us over at FX PhD back in 2008. That's when Mike and I first met him. And over the years, it's been one of the most popular courses because it's less about the software, which is After Effects, and more about the craft of VFX. And you can certainly see from that course how Gareth's role of director has been shaped by his past as a VFX artist. And as a bonus, we've actually made the course available for free, and you can check it out over at fxphd.com. We'll put a link in the podcast article on Effects Guide to get you there. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.